closed-minded provinciality turns out to leave a lasting mark of intolerance on him. It is a kind of scar he carries without pain and without any clear memory of the amputation. For all his faith, he never again prays. The other life passages that are represented in Out in the World include international travel, romantically available women, and New York City. One of the most stirring stories is The Lucid Eye in Silvertown, which describes a young son's frustration with his father's lack of sophistication on a trip the two of them take to Manhattan. Both culturally peckish in their small Pennsylvania town, father and son see the city's opportunities differently. The son wants to glimpse the possibilities of a future for himself there. The father wants only to admire the city's otherness, which his brother, who now lives there, represents. Overcome with self-consciousness and loathing, the son rages hopelessly at his father, upon whom he is still so dependent. The son wants to find a book on Vermeer, but is stymied by the kinds of obstacles that typically befall out-of-towners in comic tales of travel. The boy's lucid eye, physically injured only by an eyelash, though a visit to a doctor is made. Especially for the dainty, absurd details that can figure in social class disparities is characteristically Updikean. When my ice cream came, it was a golf ball in a flat silver dish. It kept spinning away as I dug at it with my spoon. They run out of both money and time to get the Vermeer book. On the train home, the son's tantrum ended. It had been a kind of ritual for both of us. The Lucid Eye in Silvertown is the collection's first literary glimpse of New York, a city Updike himself had always hoped to live in but once settled there, sought refuge from in search of the ordinary life he needed for material and peace. This is found not in the small town Pennsylvania of his boyhood, but in suburban Massachusetts. New York was too full of other writers and of cultural hassle, and the word game was overrun with agents and Weisenheimers, he writes in his foreword. Agents and Weisenheimers? Mused a literary friend of mine mischievously. Is that Shillington, Pennsylvania for Heimetown? No, I decided, just the headlong candor of the foreword and a defensiveness regarding provincial shelter. Also, Updike writes, he wanted free parking for my car and public education for my children, a beach to tan my skin on, a church to attend without seeming too strange. Such would have been the necessary camouflage and freedom for the kind of stories Updike has collected here, with their felt kernel of felt life. A Latvian man recently spoke to me of how meaningful Updike's work was to him when he initially discovered it. For the first time, he said, I believed I was reading something by a fiction writer who wasn't making things up. This assumption that his fiction is autobiographical may be wearying and philistine to someone such as Updike, though also familiar and anticipated. It is one of the hazards of realism, and looked at the right way, it is a compliment of the profoundest sort. The section Married Life involves the restive state of that institution, or at least of its inmates, a subject Updike has returned to throughout the decades of these stories. Adultery, the conquered citizen's silent revolt, is already having its secret meetings in Updike's living rooms and cars, though he leaves the tales of actual divorce for the latter part of the early stories. Updike's husbands are here beginning their condition of bruised pre-exile within their marriages. The Jack of both, Walter Briggs, and Should Wizard Hit Mommy, two stories in which the father's storytelling to his child figures prominently in the carpet. Tomorrow, says the little girl, I want you to tell me the story that that wizard took that magic wand and hit that mommy. Sees the woodwork of his house as a cage of moldings and rails and baseboards all around them. In Unstuck, the young husband, wanting to share his Christian faith with his wife, finds himself wincing at her cavalier remarks. Finding himself to blame. If he had given her a climax, she wouldn't be so irreligious, he imagines. Later, on his way out, he noticed the steaming cup of coffee she had poured for him, like one of those little caches one explorer leaves behind for another. To appease her, he took two scalding swallows before heading out into the wilderness of his brilliant backyard. It is Richard and John Maple, Updike's famously falling-apart couple, who most explicitly and with chilling authenticity express domestic antagonism at its most distilled, and the best stories about them are included here. Their conversations, sparring, ruthless, accusing, had the final effect of knitting them ever tighter together in a painful, helpless, degrading intimacy. Updike's dialogue possesses often the feeling of transcripts, full of the dangerous currents of marital strife, and one imagines one feels the life jolts that prompted them. "Let's not talk," says Joan Maple to her husband in Giving Blood. But his criticism of her smugness, of her unsexiness, of her stupidity, continues. "I asked you not to talk," Joan said. "Now you've said things that I'll never forget." But the marriage is sustained by their forgiving lovemaking. When their tongues at last fell silent, their bodies collapse together as two mute armies might gratefully mingle, released from the absurd hostilities decreed by two mad kings. In twin beds in Rome, the Colosseum itself is shaped like a shattered wedding cake. In Rome, Richard Maple manages his deep irritation with simultaneous doses of honey and gall. "You're such a nice woman," Richard tells his wife. "I can't understand why I'm so miserable with you." In this city of steps, they finally separate, not physically or legally, but in every other way. The marriage lets go, like an overgrown vine whose half-hidden stem has been slashed in the dawn by an ancient gardener. The stripped and shapely, Maple grieves, the loss of her departed leaves, wrote Updike in the November poem of his A Child's Calendar. Back in Boston, Joan Maple becomes involved in the civil rights movement, marching through Boston. Her self-sufficiency seems to her husband to mock as well as to re-engage him, and he finds he can neither let go of her nor love her. Although he joins her in a political march, out of sheer marital perversity, irritation again, he mimics the Negroes shockingly. It is both stubborn and correct that Updike has decided not to update his terminology for this collection. Some of the locutions, however, true to their period, are so interestingly antique now that their meanings are not always instantly clear. When, for instance, one of his characters walks into a room full of fairies, this reader, for a moment, seeing wings and wands, had no idea where we were. Family life continues, including two additional Maple stories, Sublimating and Eros Rampant, with thematizing titles. One more comically squabbling one, Your Lover Just Called, is placed in Tarbox Tales. In its climactic outburst, we see a whole segment of the Tarbox community, as well as a moment of American social history, helplessly summed up. "Go to her," Joan suddenly cried with a burst of the same defiant energy that made her, on other hungover mornings, rush through a mountain of housework. "Go to her like a man and stop trying to maneuver me into something I don't understand. I have no lover. I let Matt kiss me because he's lonely and drunk. Stop trying to make me more interesting than I am. All I am is a beat-up housewife who wants to go play tennis with some other exhausted ladies." The tales of Tarbox, a town founded by men fearful of attack, follow an unanchored interlude of stories about loneliness and romantic paralysis, the two Isolds, and precede the group of stories labeled Far Out, which, proving Cole Porter right, birds do it, includes the sexual romps of prehistoric animals during the Jurassic. Next came the Allosaurus, a carnivorous bachelor whose dangerous aura and needled grin excited the female herbivores, and various protozoa under the microscope. though without Updike's original illustrations as they first appeared in the Transatlantic Review. These satirical stories, Updike once worked on the Harvard Lampoon, are narrated as the supposed cocktail parties of the doomed and are hilarious, inspired, and frothily bleak. The party was thinning. Out of mercy as much as appetite, he ate her. She felt prickly inside him. Hurriedly, the rooms were almost depleted, it was late, he sought his hostess. She was by the doorway, her antennae frazzled from waving goodbye, but still magnificent. "Don't go," she commanded, expanding. "I have a minuscule favor to ask. Now that my children, all 13 million of them, thank God, are off at school, I've taken a part-time editing job, and my first real break is this manuscript. I'd be so grateful to have you read and comment on." The ultimate section, The Single Life, contains the most famous Maple stories and the book's climax, the sorrowing, separating, and gesturing. The Maples are largely in a gerund state. These stories are powerful with or without their predecessors. In them, the Maples separate, openly take lovers, tell the children, divorce. And here, too, is the most affecting and trenchant toast to the first wife. He saw through her words to what she was saying, that these lovers, however we love them, are not us, are not sacred as reality is sacred. We are reality. We have made children. We gave each other our young bodies. We promised to grow old together. Everything and everyone else is just shadow play, gesturing, an echo, unreal. "Isn't it amazing?" Joan says at the end, in what is one of the most unexpectedly haunting and improbably perfect lines of the book. "How a full bottle of wine isn't enough for two people anymore." Updike's storied and nuanced sense of the friendship between husbands and wives is a generous and complex one, and rewards each return visit he makes. Ordinary friendship, a subject ironically central to the work of the deeply Updike-influenced Anne Beattie, is largely missing in his fictional world. A dearth of this subject might be considered to constrict the otherwise wide and encompassing lens of this collection. But then, these are just the early stories. There are the beautiful middle stories, presumably to come, A Sandstone Farmhouse, The Cats, to name only two, in which the mother's abiding and muse-like friendship persist beyond the grave. As for the late stories, let no living writer this distinguished be thought to have written them yet. May David Kern's lavishing God and the second wife assist. 2003. Nicholson Baker's Checkpoint. Whatever serious subject the novelist Nicholson Baker explores, we must never forget that he is also being at least a little funny. Fond of the brisk, improvisatory miniature, and heir to the cerebral comedy of Donald Bartlemy, he still can seem a little misunderstood by those who would read any of his fiction as a grinding axe. Baker is not, as Leon Wieseltier suggested recently in a review of Baker's new novel Checkpoint in the New York Times Book Review, an attention seeker participating in the politics of the sewer. Much of Baker's work is quiet to the point of prayer. His last novel, A Box of Matches, about a middle-aged man getting up every day before sunrise, reads like a prose poem to fire and dawn. And although Baker is often interested in talk and even wild talk, as Wieseltier correctly notes, Baker's most famous novel, Vox, is about phone sex. He has this in common with most of the writers who ever lived. Baker's novels are largely obsessions with action versus paralysis, of both the political and the personal sort, and in his unusual explorations of this psychological mezzanine and classical theme. In The Fermata, the protagonist can in fact freeze others and stop time. In Room Temperature, an entire novel occurs while the protagonist rocks his baby to sleep. In his first novel, actually titled The Mezzanine, A torrential esprit d'escalier engenders a roaming, book-length tracking of one man's mind. He is something of an original, though one might be tempted to place him alongside the English novelist Jeff Dyer. Both are the same age, both have published amusing, inward-looking tributes to another admired writer. Dyer's Out of Sheer Rage on D.H. Lawrence, Baker's You and I on John Updike, and both use restless, unpredictable narratives to register the neurasthetic perils and pleasures of their own isolating, hyper-self-consciousness, and do so without any masculine vanity whatsoever. This, I dare say, makes them disarming and endearing literary mavericks in the heterosexual world. Perhaps one of their differences is that Baker seems seldom to leave the house. In A Box of Matches, a character airing a rug on the front porch railing is performing a gregarious public act, while the peripatetic Dyer, observing all-night raves in France, Paris trance, or his own tears in his smeared fried eggs in Detroit, yoga for people who can't be bothered to do it, seems never to stay home. Baker's wit and literary context must be borne in mind when considering his most recent novel, Checkpoint, a dialogue between two men discussing the pluses and minuses of assassinating the president. One of the men, Jay, ostensibly has a plan to do so, but his mutating renditions of it are so laughably harebrained. One includes a final greeting to Condoleezza Rice, "Stick to the piano, baby," that most readers will come to realize Jay is less villainous than he is a composite of the various ways people give theatrical voice to moral indignation. His assassination fantasy is a mirror of the one the White House had first of Saddam Hussein and then of Osama bin Laden. A decapitation that, even if realized, would not have the political consequences he claims for it, just as it is perhaps mirrored in turn by Wieseltier's own attempt to, well, assassinate Baker's book. This scummy little book is Wieseltier's own attention-grabbing opening. Where does wild talk end and something else more dangerous begin? Baker is only exploring this fictionally. Wieseltier, while committing his own wild talk in a non-fictional realm, may not actually understand this. He says of Baker's creation of the would-be assassin, Jay, that strictly speaking, Baker is not inciting a crime, though at novel's end, it may be the president is really in danger, seemingly forgetting that these are fictional characters and that in a novel, even someone called President Bush remains a fictional character. When Wieseltier lectures his readers that neither John Kerry nor John Edwards appears to live in the universe in which Checkpoint was set, or in the universe in which Checkpoint was written, an embarrassing misunderstanding of the nature of fiction is revealed. Wild talk indeed. So one must remember that Baker is funny, that he writes about paralysis inflamed by inaction, that he is interested in wild, even crazy, mock-heroic talk, and that he, as an American writer, is living in some of the most devastating years of American political history. What does a novelist like this, witnessing the world and taking note of his own as well as others' perceptions, write? Why a novel that takes the form of a two-person radio play in which a demented bum named Jay argues his suicidal, homicidal political mission? This is the one thing I have to contribute to a friend named Ben, who may or may not actually believe him, but argues back nonetheless, even to the point of desperately quoting Dr. Seuss. A person's a person no matter how small. Jay. And you've taken up photography. Ben. Yes? Jay. It's helpful to have a hobby. I have a hobby too. Ben. Jay, assassinating the president isn't a hobby. Jay. I'm sure not getting paid for it. It's pro bono all the way. And what are you going to do with these tree pictures? Checkpoint's Jay is furious about the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq, that patchwork country, and this foreign policy's dishonoring of a people. I want to say, Wolfowitz, you fuckhead. You're killing people. You're not humble enough before the mystery of a foreign country. And the triggering image for Jay's fury is something he's seen on the news, a fleeing Iraqi family killed by American soldiers at a military checkpoint. What then takes over him is a citizen's outrage intent on, or trying to seem intent on, shedding its powerlessness. First, using Ben and his tape recorder as a sounding board, he must wend his way through his many criticisms of the White House, from Rumsfeld's fortune, from NutraSuite, to the bankrupt American economy, to Lynn Cheney's denigration of Eminem. J. Lynn Cheney, this merchant of multinational misery, man, it's staggering when you take time to think about it for more than 12 seconds, and here she's all in a flusterment about the nasty lyrics of Eminem. Ben. Eminem is no favorite of mine. J. Well, no, he's not Zappa, but that woman, I'm sorry to say, is the real obscenity. Ben. Oh, Lynn Cheney did some good things when she was at the NEH. You've got to lighten up a little. She's not a viper. She was just on the board of directors. Jay. How could she be on the board of that company and look at herself in the mirror? How can she look at her husband in the mirror? Halliburton and Enron and all that. Enron wangling to profit from the pipeline across Afghanistan. It's a sickening spectacle. Ben. Do you think they look at each other in the mirror? Although Jay may never lighten up, as Ben suggests, it is Baker's sensibility to allow his book to do so, letting it go wherever it's tempted. The narrative clowns around at intermittent intervals, bringing its own light to the dark, or the Cheney's to a mirror, the gallows humor that so often marbles grief and despair. If what I do causes an upheaval, says Jay, okie doke. Since now more than ever we live in a world of bomber assassins who take their own lives along with the lives of others, their minds, from the outside, looking cracked with the determined, fantastical pageantry of misbegotten valor, Baker's brief take on the workings of one such ostensible soul is as timely as fiction gets. It does not take us convincingly inside the suicidal part of such a person's head, however. This part still seems dismissible as madness. But with the homicidal part, he is much closer. Jay is sometimes logical, even calm, in his arguments. If you say, go, man, launch the plane, start the bombing, shock and awe the living crap out of that ancient city, you are going to create assassins like me. People want to make their lives meaningful in wicked times, just as writers want to make their novels meaningful, and Ben's recommended alternatives, gentleness, love, photography, a puppy, copying out great books word for word into a notebook, however movingly simple or deeply believed or sweetly therapeutic, may not do the trick for everyone. Political argument, of course, is easier than political literature, and one can wonder how Baker's quick, stripped cry of a book can succeed as the latter. But literature occurs when one feels life on the page, and one feels life most often when one hears more than one voice in conversation there. Does the reader of Checkpoint hear more than one voice? Oh, yes. I think one doesn't have to listen too hard to hear a roar. 2004. Alice Munro's Runaway. In the myth-inflected world of Alice Munro's recent fiction, when a daughter disappears, the mother's crops are not left to wither as she searches. Instead, the mother is more likely to stay put and now, with more time on her hands, actually begins a garden at long last, with plants taking hold rather nicely, though they be, to a large extent, forget-me-nots, bittersweet, or rue. Great literature of the past two centuries has sentimentalized politics, crime, nature, and madness, but seldom the family and the wrenching incompatibility of a woman's professional or artistic expression with her familial commitments has made its way into the most undidactic of literary minds. It has appeared to powerful and unexpected effect in much of Munro's work, especially her most recent collection, Runaway. In Silence, a mother who has come late to her vocation, In one of several apparent stand-ins for literary work, she is a local talk show host with renowned powers of sympathy, and whose daughter has fled to some kind of alternative spiritual retreat, punishing her mother with discontinued contact, begins a life of solitude and herb growing. That same mother's parents, in a kind of backstory titled Soon, happily take up berry and vegetable farming after their daughter has left home. Ambivalent parenting abounds. In Trespasses, a discontented mother's psychological preoccupation contributes to the accidental death of her young daughter. In Passion, a young wife with pouches of boredom at her mouth and a bitter tinkle of a laugh explains to her in-laws, "I don't have any appetite anyway, what with the heat and the joys of motherhood," and then promptly lights up a cigarette. Families were like a poison in your blood, a character in the collection's title story thinks. There are no happy endings here, but neither are these tales tragedies. They are constructions of calm perplexity, coolly observed human mysteries. One can feel the suspense poolside, as well as any reader of the Da Vinci Code. One can cast a quick eye toward one's 9-year-old on the high dive and get back to the exact sentence where one left off. The thrilling unexpectedness of real life, which Munro rightly insists on, will in her hands keep a reader glued, even if that reader is torn by the very conflicts, work to do, kid on the high dive, dramatized therein. This is the kind of fond but exasperated mother talk she finds it easy to slip into. Munro writes in silence, though they may close with the sleepy loose ends of secrets and dreams. These stories, like life as it is recalled, more than as it is lived, move forward with speed and excitement. There are train, boat, and car wrecks, weddings and affairs, the ever-present whiff of suicide. They are determinedly full of the marks of change, cultural and emotional, upon individuals who are as startled by them as any reader. A historian friend of mine recently said, "I like Alice Munro's work because she captures so well those surprising moments of life that you never knew were possible, like suddenly finding yourself in a cornfield with your pants around your ankles." Munro's interest in life's incongruous phases and fragments has given her stories their distinctive shape. Decades collide, intersect, are placed side by side in a charged and vibrating conversation. Munro has said she sees stories architecturally, as a house whose various rooms one can roam in and out of, foregoing any prescribed order. This surely accounts for the nonlinear aspect of so many of her narratives, that memory and passion reorder a life and cause events to fall meaningfully out of sequence in the mind, often seems to be Munro's point. Four of the stories here are essentially two novellas composed of linked parts, carrying their characters from youth to late middle age. There is less back and forth between time periods in these novellas than there usually is in Munro. This is a successful length for Munro because it allows her, by means of tableau, to use time deeply and extendedly as both tool and subject. The story for the ages here, however, is surely the title one, with its multiple runaways, its ghostly gothic moments, and its exploration of erotic love, all narrative ingredients Munro has made her own. Carla, with the help of a friend, runs away from her increasingly disturbed and hostile husband. She previously ran away with him, leaving her family. Their photo albums, their vacations, their Cuisinart, their powder room, their walk-in closets, their underground lawn sprinkling system, for a more authentic life. So much for the comforts of authenticity. Halfway to her new destination of Toronto, however, the strange and terrible thing coming clear to her is that she cannot imagine life without her husband. As Carla flees, he persistently keeps his place in her life. What would she put in his place? She is drawn helplessly, that is, erotically, back, compromised by grief and uncertainty, willing to pay whatever violent price is required to keep her marriage. And in Monroe, it is always a little violent. The loss of her pet goat, Carla imagines, which is to say, understands, there is no difference for Monroe's female characters, that her husband has punished her by killing it, is an echo of the many violent visions that Monroe's wives have of the men they've chosen and of men in general. In Open Secrets, 1994, a man spraying schoolgirls with a hose, Monroe's work is interested in men with menacing water, especially hoses, one or two of them appear in the current collection, is envisioned by the story to be a murderer. His is a crime his wife has had to accept. Though, like the goat's death in Runaway, there is a brief and barbaric and necessary act reconsecrating the marriage. In this new collection, the story Powers concludes with the incarceration of a woman by her husband after her psychic powers dwindle and can no longer satisfactorily pay the bills. The psychic wife knows what the husband is up to, or so the story with its own clairvoyance imagines, but she remains passive before her fate. In Monroe's world, wives glimpse the cold wickedness of their men, but must devise the psychological ceremony that allows them to set that glimpse aside. It is too late in their lives for them to do otherwise. Only the very young have the emotional luxury of successfully fleeing. For a young person, a pristine heart untainted by the more damaging forms of forgiveness is still in charge. In Baptizing, from Lives of Girls and Women, 1971, Monroe wrote eloquently of two young lovers, one of whom has almost drowned the other. Men and water again. In Ovid, water fuses a couple's sexuality. In Monroe, it distinguishes and separates. If we had been older, we would certainly have hung on, haggled over the price of reconciliation, explained and justified and perhaps forgiven, and carried this into the future with us. But as it was, we were close enough to childhood to believe in the absolute seriousness and finality of some fights, unforgivability of some blows. We had seen in each other what we could not bear. And we had no idea that people do see that and go on and hate and fight and try to kill each other various ways, then love some more. Therein lies part of the contradiction of feeling coursing through so much of Monroe's work, which she expresses best three paragraphs later in that same early story. Unconnected to the life of love, uncolored by love, the world resumes its own, its natural and callous importance. This is first a blow, then an odd consolation. And already I felt my old self, my old devious, ironic, isolated self, beginning to breathe again and stretch and settle, though all around it my body clung cracked and bewildered in the stupid pain of loss. The artistic self, devious, ironic, isolated, resides at odds with the tender lover self in the same finely riven person. Monroe is hardly the first writer to worry this incompatibility. Henry James, in his very different way, devoted a lifetime to it, and, like Monroe, was often interested in placing that theme in ghost stories of both the natural and the supernatural kind. But she is one of the most explicit in noting its obscenity, its terribleness, as well as its almost comedic unsolvability. Perhaps owing partly to this, her writing never loses its juice, never goes brittle. It also never equivocates or blinks, but simply lets observations speak for themselves. In fiction, real turmoil is made artificial turmoil only to seem real again. This is literary realism's wish, and one of Monroe's compelling accomplishments. Seduction may be baneful, Elizabeth Hardwick wrote in Seduction and Betrayal, even tragic, but the seducer, at his work, is essentially comic. Monroe's romantically game women seem to understand this, even as girls, and it may be the thing that gives them, especially in this collection, their fearlessness and dignity and resilience, as well as their outwardly sleepwalking straight man quality. How else to explain the sexual situations they so easily wander into? Juliet, in Chance, quickly takes up with an older married man she meets on a train, pursuing him to Whale Bay on the British Columbian coast, although she has learned almost nothing about him, and he doesn't even know her last name. In Passion, Grace, cued by little except a notion that romance should involve impulsiveness, abandons her fiancé to take up for an afternoon with his alcoholic older brother, whom she has just met. All the women here are attempted runaways of some sort, and they seem to feel that the situation they run toward harbors more truth and hope than the difficult daily world they run from, though the story itself will not judge. Monroe's women are unforensic in their knowledge, perceptive guessers, quiet visionaries, fortuitous survivors, and the stories are uninsistent in their stance. It has been said that erotic love, like certain religions, seems to contain the meaning of life without actually disclosing it. And Monroe's narratives of this, though they may, in a paragraph here or there, advocate for mystery, in general back off from faith or argument of any kind. Monroe's world, with its small, violent corners, is a revelation of a specific element of human experience, the impossibility of life without tedium, surprise, or paradox. There seems nothing missing in this yet again brilliant collection. If the book's last words regarding powers beginning to crumble and darken tenderly into something like soot and soft ash betray any authorial worry, the beauty of the line gives the lie to it. Someone writing at this level well into her 70s, outliving the female friends to whose memory the book is dedicated and who must have been part of its inspiration, is a literary inspiration herself. But if there is anything missing, it may be Hired Girl and Fathers, two haunting stories that were published in The New Yorker some time ago but have yet to appear in a collection. Maybe even more stories are lying in wait. Such first-rate abundance is an astonishment in any lifetime, let alone that of a middle-class mother, and is, to rework Faulkner's quip regarding Keats, worth any number of young daughters. Though, of course, for the writer, it is always more complicated than that. For the reader, however, it is a lovely and simple matter of greed and joy. 2004. Joan Silber. When the National Book Award nominations were announced this past autumn, they were greeted with a great amount of grumbling. Grumbling that I began to feel was fueled in part by the malaise presidential politics had caused to befall every conversation in the country. But grumbling nonetheless. The nominated books were criticized for having been written by relatively unknown women who all lived in New York City. Though such a demographic fact might equally have been reason for celebration. The choice of Alfreda Jelinek for this past fall's Nobel Prize in Literature was faulted, too. Not for her uninflected pessimism or the threads of caustic misanthropy that weave through her work, and which in fact group her with many other recent winners, but for her insufficient fame outside Vienna, which does not. The revenge of the midgets, one writer said to me of the National Book Award nominations. They should change the name to the Gotham Municipal Book Awards, said another. How are we supposed to sell books, cried various publishers, if the book awards do this to us? Giving it away that a book's future has already been pretty much designed in advance by a company's sales force, who look to an award neither as due respect nor as cultural candy, with all of candy's meaninglessness and slightly sickening fun, but as further marketing assistance on an already commercially blessed book. Even boasting a book award, a novel less well-funded right from the start, can have a hard time shaking off its publisher's preconceptions, turning around, and having some other life. That is, if the award comes as a surprise. But of course, if the award is not a surprise, There will be a different sort of grumbling, as no doubt we will soon witness with the initiation of the Quill Awards, a new People's Choice-style prize set up just this year by Reed Business Information and various local NBC-affiliated television stations, apparently in response to all that autumnal muttering. Literary muttering attended to at all, sad to say, can seem an amusing and heartening thing. The response to the National Book Awards that left the biggest impression on me was this one by a former nominee. He said, "Well, all I know is that if Joan Silver's Ideas of Heaven is on the list, it means the judges are actually reading the books." Ideas of Heaven, shortlisted for the Story Prize as well as the National Book Award, it won neither, is a beautiful and peculiar collection of interlinked stories. A ring of stories, as the author herself describes it, since the stories form a kind of circle, the last story cycling back to give new meaning to the first, and all the stories having small, sometimes arbitrary, sometimes dramatic links among them. Its author has written four previous works of fiction, including the novel Lucky Us, an unintimidated update of La Bohème, Aid Substituted for Consumption, Brooklyn Lofts for Parisian Garrets, Verdi's Violetta for Puccini's Mimi, and In My Other Life, more stories of scrappy metropolitan young people in blithe downward mobility, making a go of it in restaurants, bars, video stores, and the drug trade. Even when Silver's characters survive to middle class, middle-aged adulthood, shadows follow. "They have a penned-in area for the kids," Nathan said, "and then the rest of the park is for the dope dealers. Don't think it doesn't confuse me to be in there with the swings." Joan Silver may be one of those writers, such as Meg Wolitzer, who fast out of the gate — Wolitzer's first novel was written when she was an undergraduate — Silber's first book, the eerily mature and accomplished 1980 novel Household Words, won the Penn Hemingway Award — those preening midgets — have miraculously become even better in middle age. Lucky Us, Silber's last book, a haunting bicameral portrait of two doomed lovers, is still not adequate preparation for the emotional and narrative intricacies of Ideas of Heaven. Both are written in the first person, from the point of view of different people who, oddly, share the same voice. It is one of Silber's limitations, turned brazen, wise refusal, that she has not bothered to create different voices for her characters. Everyone speaks in the same lively, funny, intelligent voice, the voice of the book. This comes to seem Silber's point, that what is alike about us trumps what is distinct. And in Ideas of Heaven, especially, even more than in Lucky Us, this is a necessary aspect of the conception. The book could not exist without the continuous sound and family of these like-voiced minds. The sameness of the narrative voices, in completely disparate circumstances, is what in part creates the ring that ensures both the strange comedy and the spiritual underpinning of a collection that, largely owing to the vehicle of its singular and uniform voice, has all the satisfactions of a novel. Arguably part narrative acrostic, part musical round, Ideas of Heaven is divided, formally, into six sections. It begins with the story My Shape, whose wise, breezy, declarative mezzo belongs here to Alice, a would-be actress and dancer whose buxom body keeps her from the ballet she loves. That she tells us straight away that she liked the arabesques and the leaping, and even the strictness of Miss Alabin drilling us in the six positions, may at first seem an editorial oversight, as there are only five positions in ballet. But as the number six is key to the structure of the book, one is inclined to allow for the error's intentionality, and can then imagine that the sixth position, for Alice, may be the one she finds herself in after she has busily renounced ballet and her young French husband. "I went a little crazy. I walked around in a heavy, dressy cape and told the children I had a gun underneath it." In longing to be in a Broadway musical, Alice begins taking lessons from a cruel and jaded dance teacher named Duncan Fishbach. The tools of his trade were mockery and command. In Fishbach's ultimate lesson, he orders her to lick his shoe. Ah, there it is, the sixth position. I had my own ideas about a higher purpose, says Alice, but not enough ideas. I could have used more. She winds up back in France with a second French husband, Gilles, a Buddhist and widower, and a new life as a yoga instructor. The next story, The High Road, belongs to the sadistic Duncan Fishbach, who speaks in the same animated rhythms as Alice, though Alice is nothing to him. Vocal echo aside, she is not in this story at all, except as one of the nameless students Duncan is eventually forced to take in when his own theatrical career collapses. What Duncan's real story is, along with all the others in this book, is a love story involving unequal affections. Abjectness, that sixth position, presents itself here in the form of the bitterly unconsummated crush. As Duncan himself says, infatuation, when it happened, could be visionary, a lust from another zone, from the true zone, the molten center of the earth. I was in my 20s, listening to a lot of jazz, and I thought in phrases like that. The High Road recounts Duncan's story as a two-time loser in love. First he falls for Andre, an African-American trumpeter, elegantly dressed, courtesy of a day job, in a men's clothing store in Midtown. After sabotaging that relationship, Duncan falls for a grieving young tenor who has just lost his boyfriend to AIDS. Love has made me live in ceaseless fire, sings the tenor, with a sorrowful yearning appealing to Duncan. The tenor's favorite drink is Campari, his favorite poet, Gaspar Estampa, whose sonnets are a 1500s version of the blues. Hopeless passion, notes Duncan, was still in high style in certain corners of the gay world. His infatuation with this tenor involves rituals of cooking, whimpering restraint, and reveries spiked with scheming. I had underestimated the depth of the enterprise, the large and moving drama involved. He cannot win the tenor's love. He imagines that to the young tenor, he must seem like some evil old elf, untempting even for a minute. The High Road becomes, in this piece, celibacy itself, a Buddhist-style renunciation of passion until it becomes not gone, but at least reduced to a hum, though a hum that was always in my ears. Thus begin the two angles on romantic desire worked simultaneously in Ideas of Heaven. Romance as a condition of unsatisfied yearning that must be transformed to a tantric discipline, versus romance as an ennobling comedy of sexual humiliation, here and there rewarding with love. Oh, the drama of small semantic differences. The third story, they must be read in sequence, narrated in the now familiar voice of Alice Duncan, is told by none other than the 16th century poet Gaspar Estampa, author of the tenor's pining lyrics. That her very American-sounding voice will not remind you at all of a 16th-century Venetian deters the intrepid Joan Silber not a whit. Gaspara begins her artistic life full of yearning for an unknown agony. She soon finds the ostensible objective correlative for this craving in a tall, handsome blonde named Colatino di Colalto. Plenty of first sons were given this kind of repeating name, she informs us defensively. Gaspara becomes, as Silber would need her to, sick with attraction, hoping to slake a sacred thirst. Like Duncan, she is not afraid to suffer openly, and although her pre-modern times won't allow her to resort to heavy breathing into a telephone during anonymous late-night calls, surely she would if she could, as does Duncan, she suffers the piercing, binding, pressing of the heart that honors her model, Petrarch, in his eternally unrealized love for Laura. What Gaspara sings in public is, what any lover knows, You'll be sorry later. I hope you feel 1/1000th of the pain I feel. Why are you so cruel? She notes, people liked best the most mournful and complaining of my songs. When her lover at long last returns from war, I asked how everything had gone in France, and then he began to tell me at length, which was not what I wanted. The openly American diction and vernacular rhythms restaged in 16th century Venice may seem an old gag, reminiscent of loopy send-ups of Shakespeare. But in this context, which is also earnest and of a piece with the book's synoptic look at desire's mischief and heat, it forms comedic moments that are a delight against the backdrop of the premature death we know is coming in a story titled Gaspar Estampa, 1523-54. He got up very early the next day to hunt for boar, and he had me get up with him to breakfast downstairs before it was fully light. Why a man would come home from war to chase a wild animal with a spear was not something I could understand. When, of course, things end badly. We were all smiling, as if love's wreckage were a shared joke, which I suppose it was. Many of Silber's fictional couples have screaming fights in public places, and Peggy and Tom in Ashes of Love, the book's fourth story, are among them. They are connected to Gaspar Estampa, too, through Rilke, whose poetry Tom continues to read on and off throughout his life, Rilke invoking Estampa herself as a figure to admire, as she exhausted herself so intriguingly in Objectless Love. I was interested, says Tom, in what is again the book's sole narrative voice, in what Rilke said about lovers. He was always citing them as a distant class of people, because I was one half of a fiercely attached couple. Tom's life with Peggy initially involves a lot of travel, Yugoslavia, Turkey, and finally Thailand, where Silber's motif of Buddhism first presents itself to Tom. After he has returned to the States, has a son with Peggy, and is then abandoned by her for another man, he begins where he left off in Thailand, pursuing serenity in a Buddhist meditation group. Ashes of Love follows Tom straight through another marriage up to the faraway death of Peggy. He has never been able to love anyone the way he did her, and his new wife, Matina, feels Tom's psychic distances, accusing him of using Buddhism, his own noise and passion management system, to learn not to feel what he isn't feeling anyway. All this yuppie Buddhism might be easy for a reader to deride, but the sweet stubbornness with which it is continually inserted in Silber's book wins over even a recalcitrant skeptic. Perhaps religion has always been a kind of hospital. And in this story too, as in the final one, we feel it is perhaps one of the few decent refuges for the lover whose one great love in life has already occurred. The comings and goings of love, as they are often dramatized by Silber, are a complex exchange of one kind of loneliness for another. The fifth and title story is in some ways the most anomalous and fascinating, if risky, and not entirely successful. Narrated in the Alice Duncan Gaspara Tom voice by a Christian missionary's wife in China during the Boxer Rebellion, the story has the narrator killed at the end, a narrator device that sets up an impossible point from which to tell the story, a point seldom seen outside Faulkner or the film Sunset Boulevard, although Susanna Moore relied on it in her novel In the Cut and others have tried. Ideas of Heaven is connected to Ashes of Love through the presence of an heirloom Chinese comb sent home to a relative and handed down through generations to Tom's new wife, Matina. It also has in common with the book's other stories the project of fitting an entire life into a short space, and shares with them too, despite its Victorian time period, a narrator whose loving enjoyment of sex is articulated with elegance and happiness. He was as much a novice to the act as I was, the missionary's wife says of her new husband, and we rowed through these new waters together. I saw why a man and wife must never leave one another, having been to these places in each other's company. Ideas of Heaven is connected to the final story, the same ground, through this story's narrator, a Parisian named, interestingly enough, Gilles, whose great-great-uncle was a Benedictine priest and survivor of the Siege of Peking. It is in this sixth and concluding story, the same ground, that all the book's themes and all of Silber's skills come together most orchestrally and touchingly. The same ground even serves as a kind of curtain call of missing persons from earlier in the book. André the trumpet player makes a brief appearance as a now successful musician in Paris. Peggy makes an appearance as an angry American whom Gilles once picked up hitchhiking. Alice, from the inaugural story, My Shape, turns up in a yoga class to become Gilles' second wife. Marco Polo, September 11th, and race relations all have a poeticized presence here in this already thrice-told tale of grievous romantic loss. Loss that haunts and frees and enlarges and scars the now newly spiritualized loser. In another link to China, Gilles is married to the North African historian Sylvie, who in seeking permission to research in China is killed in a terrorist bombing on the steps of the Chinese embassy in Paris. Says Sylvie's mourning mother, "The whole world is going to blow up. That's what they want. It's going to be nothing." Says Gilles, after the shocking mortal consumption of his wife, "I was doing my best not to think about anything beyond what to make for supper. I didn't want to hear about someone else's bloody outrage over some murderous stupidity in the past. This was an odd state of mind for someone who taught history for a living and went forth every day to explain to 16-year-olds why they should care about the Hundred Years' War." Once, when the class is discussing the Bader-Meinhof gang, one of the students says, "I admire the beauty of their convictions, and to blow people up is not the worst evil." And then there is a sudden silence. Gilles is the only person in the room who was freed of wretched embarrassment. The loss of Gilles' wife is sandwiched between two love affairs. The first, while Gilles is still married to Sylvie, is with a goatherdess named Edmé. Again, Silber knows no fear. The depictions of Gilles as adulterer are gentle and searching. "I was becoming wily and hollow from pretense," he admits to himself, "and no one said anything, so perhaps I was good at it." He feels even years later that perhaps he could not be at close quarters with a woman I loved without staining myself with lies. When he finally leaves his mistress, "It was a terrible, sentimental conversation. Both of our voices broke the whole time. I praised her loveliness and her fineness, and everything I said sounded false, though it was true. We had to stop talking so that words could mean something again in our mouths." He returns to his wife with desire and devotion, but when she dies, Paris becomes enraging to walk in. Gilles' second love affair is as a widower, with the aforementioned Alice, who welds this ring of stories by returning at the end as an expatriate yogin, a kind of cheerful, that is, American, Brigitte Bardot, but with something smudged and sad about her. And yet, the dead Sylvie remains forever like an inner skin within Gilles. That one life contains many, that these lives overlap and end without being complete, that the soul's quest often runs parallel with the heart's, not meeting. That for better or worse, in sickness and in health, the story of love-addled Romeo and his sexually purposeful Juliet remains one of humanity's truest narratives, imprinted over and over again in our actions and fates. That we are more alike than different in our desires and voices, and connected in the largest and smallest and most astonishingly random of ways, are a few of the points and opinions that converge by the close of this book and help release its emotion unexpectedly but profoundly. Everything ends in tears, says this book, as does this book, to the extent that it ends at all. For like life, the narrative curls back around and starts over again. Or sort of.